Alrighty, folks, and welcome to the Chronicle Podcast channel. This is episode 36, The Establishment of Shulhan, Part 2. So in today's episode, we will begin where we left from last week, and we will dive into Liu Bei's time in Jin Province, and then the earth-shattering battle, which was the Battle of Red Cliffs, or Kirby Zhang, and then what happens after that. Now, I must say, I do apologise for the lack of sound effects and stuff that I usually put in from last week's episode, and it's because work has been super busy, and I will go back and try and edit that sometime in the future. But anyway, the year that we'll start off in is around the year 206 or 207, where Liu Bei was stationed on the northern tip of Jin Province, which bordered the territory of Cao Cao. Cao Cao, for his part, was consolidating his holdings in the north after his victory at Guandu. Everyone and their pet dog knew that Cao Cao's gaze had now shifted south, as the biggest threat to him now was Jin Province because Liu Bei was there and Dongwu to the southeast. But while Cao Cao was pacifying north, Jin Province was actually in a state of relative peace. The civil war that ravaged China had moved away from the area, and scholars sought refuge within the province. Liu Bei himself knew he needed intelligent advisors to help his political ambitions, and he began to ask around for intelligent men to join him. It was during this time that he heard of a brilliant scholar by the name of Sleeping Dragon, or Shui Long in Chinese. Nowadays, this man, of course, is Zhuge Liang. But not wanting to seek a lord, Zhuge Liang preferred to stay in his old hut up in the mountains and travelled around the country. Liu Bei, eager to meet this man, set off to find him. When Liu Bei discovered the whereabouts of Zhuge Liang's home, he set off to the mountains to find him, with his two brothers Guan Yu and Zhang Fei. But when they arrived, Zhuge Liang was not there. Liu Bei was understandably disappointed, but simply said, okay, then set off home once again. The second time Liu Bei tried to find Zhuge Liang, a young boy was at the house, but told the warlord that Zhuge Liang was travelling around the riverlands. Disappointed once again, Liu Bei set off back home. The third time Liu Bei tried to find Zhuge Liang, he was successful, and he made sure to pay the strategist his deepest respects, and he made Guan Yu and Zhang Fei do the same. Now, understandably, Zhang Fei and Guan Yu were rather peeved off by all of this, because they felt that Liu Bei shouldn't need to pay respects to anyone. And in a rage, Zhang Fei tried to set fire to Zhuge Liang's house. But that's all in Romance of the Three Kingdoms. I'm not sure if it actually happened. Anyway, it was in this little hut up in the mountains within Jin Province that Zhuge Liang joined Liu Bei and drew out the Long Zhong plan. The plan was simple. Take over Jin Province, then Yi Province, which is also known as the Riverlands or Shu. Then use these two provinces as a base of operations. From there, Liu Bei could ally himself with the up-and-coming warlord Sun Quan in the east, and they could invade Cao Cao in the north together. Now, of course, once Cao Cao was dealt with, Liu Bei could then gobble up Sun Quan's territory. All Liu Bei needed now was an excuse to take over Jin Province. But this was a bit of a predicament for the warlord, according to Romance of the Three Kingdoms, that is, as Liu Biao was his kinsman and a member of the imperial family, so he was a distant relative of Liu Bei's. Thank you. So how could Liu Bei legitimately take over the province? Well, luckily for Liu Bei, and unluckily for Liu Biao, the latter died in the year 208. Now, one would think that Liu Bei would be more than willing to annex the province, but Liu Biao actually had two sons, both of whom he didn't really name as heir, so the same problem that Yuan Shao had up in the north. The eldest son was Liu Qi, and the youngest son was Liu Tong. Now, to cut a long story short, and Liu Bei was involved in all of this, Liu Qi's mother died when giving birth to him, and then Liu Biao remarried a woman named Lady Tai, who then used her position to get her family members in positions of power. It became clear, when the old man died, that it was the Tai family back in Liu Tong who would inherit the province, and not the eldest son, Liu Qi. Upon getting the province, Tao Tao moved in, and of course Sun Quan was trying to move in as well, because they were trying to take advantage of this unstable situation within Jin province. And to everyone's shock, Liu Tong immediately surrendered to Tao Tao, and yes, Liu Bei, stationed in the north, was quickly in a very bad situation. So, what he did was he started to retreat south to try and get away from Tao Tao, who was encroaching on the province. Liu Qi stationed himself at Jiangxia, and that is at the border between Jin and Wu. The march back for Liu Bei was extremely slow, and this was due to the fact that the majority of Liu Bei's followers, around 100,000 people, were just civilians who wanted to follow the warlord wherever he went. Now, surprisingly, the people, and I'm talking the women, the children, and the men who couldn't fight, did actually follow Liu Bei in his retreat away from Tao Tao, and that is historical fact, which does highlight Liu Bei's reputation as a man of the people. But I do not know what good following a man with no army, no land, would do for a woman or a child, considering that they had to march hundreds of miles to the south, and they were being hotly pursued by 5,000 of Tao Tao's elite cavalry along the way. Tao Tao's forces did finally catch up to Liu Bei's forces at Chamban Bridge, where it was basically a last stand, and Liu Bei tried to protect the people. But the effort failed, and Liu Bei was handedly defeated. The majority of the people who did follow Liu Bei were captured and sent to the territory from whence they came. Liu Bei and his core team of followers, however, did manage to escape, and they crossed the Yangtze River to Jiangxia, only just escaping Tao Tao's clutches. And Liu Bei, as well as his forces, lived to fight another day. Putting the Longzhong plan into effect, Liu Bei sent Zhuge Liang to Dongwu to try and forge an alliance with Sun Quan. Now, this task would actually be very difficult, as a lot of people within Sun Quan's court were unsurprisingly advocating surrender to Tao Tao's forces. As soon as Zhuge Liang arrived in Sun Quan's capital at Jianye, scholars from Sun Quan's court all tried to belittle Zhuge Liang and force him into debates unfavourable to him. But because Zhuge Liang was certainly one of the most clever people of the age, he put all of these scholars back in their place one by one. You know, they would ask questions such as, what can Liu Bei offer to an alliance? And Zhuge Liang always had a very clever answer up his sleeve. And Zhuge Liang does need to get credit here, because he did play an important role in forging this alliance, because after having a discussion with Sun Quan, the deal was made, and Sun Quan allied himself with Liu Bei. Furthermore, any talk of surrendering from that day forth meant losing your head. With the alliance in place, the stage was set for this epic clash between the alliance of Liu Bei and Sun Quan up against the enormous warlord Cao Cao. On paper, the odds looked stacked against the coalition forces. Between them, Liu Bei and Sun Quan only had around 50,000 troops at their disposal, whereas Cao Cao claimed to have 800,000. But please, take that number with a pinch of salt. Not only that, Cao Cao's army's morale was high as they were on a roll and hadn't tasted a major defeat yet. On the other hand, Liu Bei had no solid footing, whereas Sun Quan only controlled a small area of land in comparison to Cao Cao. But the reality of the situation was that Cao Cao's forces had three disadvantages. The first was that his men were exhausted from the forced marches down south. The second, his men were not used to naval warfare and they would have to adapt to cross the Yangtze River. And third, his men were not acclimatized to southern China, so disease was spreading through his ranks. On the other hand, the coalition of Liu Bei and Sun Quan had three advantages. First, their troops were fresh, apart from Liu Bei's, but he didn't make up much of the numbers anyway. Second, the Wu forces excelled at naval warfare under their commander Zhou Yu. And third, the south of China was their homeland, so they didn't need to worry about acclimatizing themselves. Now Cao Cao tried to launch his invasion as swiftly as possible and sent a contingent of men to cross the Yangtze River to set up a beachhead. But despite having superior numbers, Cao Cao's forces failed to win a victory in the skirmish with the coalition forces. After this initial battle, both sides decided to withdraw temporarily, and a stalemate ensued. Cao Cao didn't want to risk a naval battle, as he knew that he was inferior to Zhou Yu in this regard. Well, the coalition didn't believe that they had the numbers to attack the Northern Army. Now, in Romance of the Three Kingdoms, there are many cases of the two sides trying to infiltrate spies to the other's camps, there's deception, backstabbing within the coalition forces, and an intense rivalry between Zhuge Liang and Zhou Yu breaks out. However, for the purpose of time, I'm not going to focus on this area. Stick more to the facts here, and I will discuss Zhuge Liang and Zhou Yu in more depth in the future, but not now. Two events occurred which changed the history of China for the next few hundred years, right up until the Sui reunited the realm, and this was at the Battle of Redcliffe. Cao Cao tried to compensate for his men getting seasick on their boats on the Yangtze River by chaining them all together. That way, the ships would be more stable and the sickness would be kept at a minimum. But by doing this, Cao Cao's ships would move very slowly, and that is the first event which changed the history of China. The second, it comes from a man or a general named Huang Gai, who thought of a very bold strategy. Huang Gai wrote a letter to Cao Cao and he said, "Dear Prime Minister, the Sun family have treated me very well and I shouldn't be doing this. However, you can see the situation right now with the six commanderies of Jiandong up against the millions of people in central China. Even non-military combatants can see the outcome of this war. Furthermore, that villain Zhou Yu, he is arrogant and he thinks he can break a stone with an egg. He thinks he is the smartest and the best military strategist in the world. He is not reasonable. When the soldiers perform good deeds, they don't get rewarded. They also get punished for very little. All of these things that Zhou Yu has done has made us old followers of the Sun family heartbroken. However, I have heard you, Prime Minister, are a reasonable and generous man. Therefore, I am willing to take my men, my ships, and my grain supply over to your side to build up my career and reputation under your services, where I can brush off this shame and humiliation I have went through under the command of Zhou Yu. Sincerely, Huang Gai. Now, Cao Cao was a suspicious leader, but he did believe Huang Gai's defection to be genuine. And this is probably due to a large number of coalition soldiers already abandoning the Liu Sun army. And again, in Romance of the Three Kingdoms, Huang Gai was publicly denouncing Zhou Yu, to which he received a harsh punishment of 100 strokes, and then when Cao Cao got the letter, he believed in the defection. Huang Gai, in his letter, set a date and told Cao Cao to be ready for his forces then. In anticipation, on that night, Cao Cao stood watching as 10 of Huang Gai's ships sailed towards him with the wind in their sails, thinking all was going according to plan. As the ships sailed closer and closer, all was still well, until, all of a sudden, the ships were lit ablaze, where they then crashed into Cao Cao's fleet. Chained together and with the wind against them, the Tao fleet soon caught on fire and it spread across the entire fleet. All of Tao Tao's fleet was incinerated, and all Cao Cao could do was watch in horror as he seen his fleet, as well as his hopes of unifying China, burn on the Yangtze River. Cao Cao didn't have time to think about his next move though, as whilst his fleet was burning on one area of the river, Zhou Yu led a lightning strike across another channel of the water and slammed into Cao Cao's forces. The fighting was running through the night, and it was very clear that the Wu forces had won a decisive victory. Cao Cao then ordered a general retreat. His men, terrified of the raging fire, all ran as fast as they could away from the Dongwu forces and trampled over each other to get away from the battle. All order within Cao Cao's army was gone, and it was a free-for-all. Cao Cao was retreating, and he thought he got away, until suddenly, Liu Bei's forces appeared and slammed into the Cao army once again. The battle kept getting worse and worse for Cao Cao's forces, but the leader of the north did manage to retreat back to Xuchang, leaving his cousin Cao Ren to defend a key passage on the river, a city named Jianlin. The coalition forces immediately followed up on their victory and began besieging the city. But it was actually a lot more difficult than they expected, as Cao Ren set up a solid defence. But soon, Zhou Yu ordered Guan Yu to take over key cities which have been part of Jianlin's supply line, and very soon, the soldiers inside the city would starve to death. Realising that he could not hold his southern territories, Cao Cao ordered his cousin to retreat back to the north. Now that the threat of Cao Cao had been dealt with, Sun Quan and Liu Bei wanted to capitalize on their victory. However, because Liu Bei still had no territory of his own, he acted first, and immediately took the commanderies in the south of Jing province and made Zhuge Liang the administrator of the newly acquired lands. Sun Quan, understandably, was pretty miffed by this, as at the end of the day, it was Dongwu who did the heavy lifting in defeating Cao Cao's forces. And the new territory, in his eyes, was rightfully his. But, using cunning, Liu Bei and Zhuge Liang said that they will borrow Jing province, and once they have conquered new territory, they will give it back to Sun Quan. Now, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be buying that at all. However, Sun Quan, wary that Cao Cao was still a threat, and not wanting to look dishonourable, relented and agreed. Liu Bei then seized all of Jing province and started recruiting and amassing armies under his command. Finally, after years of defeat after defeat, not having a permanent base, Liu Bei had a home and a base of operations. He then used this to try and expand. Liu Bei knew that he was still too weak to even consider taking on Cao Cao or Sun Quan, but the governor of Yi province, or the Riverlands, or modern-day Sichuan and Chongqing, Liu Jiang, was extremely weak. To the north of Liu Jiang, there was also another warlord called Zhang Lu in the Hangzhong region, which is like where the Han River is. All Liu Bei needed to invade this region was an excuse. And it came when there was reports that Zhang Lu was preparing to invade Chengdu, so Liu Jiang invited Liu Bei to the Riverlands to repel this invasion. The reason why Liu Jiang chose Liu Bei was because they were distant relatives, therefore he thought Liu Bei could be trusted. Liu Bei was also the closest available ally, and he was an experienced commander after all. Interestingly though, when the envoys came to seek an audience with Liu Bei, they revealed that they wanted to defect to Liu Bei and hand over the Riverlands to him. Trying to maintain his good name, however, Liu Bei did as he was asked from Liu Jiang, and he stationed his forces on the border between Sichuan and Hangzhong. But whilst he was stationed there, Liu Bei kinda went on a PR campaign within the region, treating everyone he met with immense kindness and making sure the people knew that this guy ought to be in control of the region. Quickly, Liu Jiang caught wind of this, and he seen that Liu Bei was trying to usurp him, so then of course he declared war on him in the year 212. Liu Jiang tried his best. He sent general after general to fight with Liu Bei's forces, but there was simply no match. Liu Bei had spent his entire life fighting, whereas Liu Jiang and his generals hadn't fought a battle since the Yellow Turban Rebellion almost 30 or 40 years prior to this. Some of his generals fought to the death, whereas others simply defected as they seen where the wind was blowing. By the year 214, Chengdu, the capital of Yi province, had been surrendered to Liu Bei, and it seemed as if his time was now coming. Now, in the years before and during the time Liu Bei spent in Sichuan, the other warlords, Cao Cao and Sun Quan, weren't idly sitting by and watching the show, by the way. They were consolidating their own power, and Cao Cao himself was engaged in fighting wars in the northwest of China. But here is where we have the three kingdoms established now. You've got Cao Cao in the north, Sun Quan in the southeast, and Liu Bei in the southwest. So for next week, we will try to round off the three kingdoms with looking at each kingdom once they were established, for example, the way they were governed, and then we will look at how this period of civil war all ended. And then, of course, the Jin dynasty won the whole thing in the year 266 with the Sima clan. After that, I will be posting my discussion with the epic podcaster Zhong Zhu, who has done a podcast on the entire book Romance of the Three Kingdoms, so I would highly recommend listening to that. And right now, he is currently doing a podcast about another famous piece of Chinese literature, The Water Margin, also known as Shui Hu. I will leave links to both shows' websites within the description where you can check them out. But from me, Dean the Chronicler, thank you very much for listening to the show, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.